They live at the very bottom of town, not far from a dirty, frothy creek that stems from the river. The defining feature of the place is that the only thing the Rose brothers do is fight. If I go there in the morning, they're arguing. If I go in the evening, they're fist fighting. At all times, they're hurling abuse at each other. Their ma can't control them. To cope, she drinks. She falls asleep on the couch as the latest soap washes over the screen. Within a week, I've watched those boys fight at least a dozen times, until one night, the Tuesday, they have the worst one yet. It erupts out the front door into the side of the house, and the older brother, Daniel, beats the absolute Christ out of Gavin. Gavin's buckled over, and Daniel lifts him up by the collar. He lectures his brother and shakes his head back and forth at the same time. "I told you not to touch my stuff, all right?" He bangs him to the ground before walking purposefully back inside. Gavin is left there, and after a few minutes he rises to his hands and knees as I watch from over the street. Eventually, after checking his face for blood, he swears and begins half-walking, half-running down the street. All the way he's talking of hatred and killing his brother, until he finally stops and sits in the gutter at the very end of the slope where Bush lingers around the road. This is my moment. I walk over and stand in front of him. And I have to tell you, a nervousness manages to sidle up next to me. The kid's tough and won't give me anything for free. There's a streetlight standing over us, watching. There's a breeze, cooling the sweat on my face. And slowly, I see my shadow step on Gavin Rose. He looks up.
"What the hell do you want?"
There are hot tears cooking on his face, and his eyes bite. I shake my head. Nothing.
"Well, get away from me then, you first prize wanker, or I'll beat the living shit out of you."
He's 14, I think. Remember Edgar Street? This is a piece of cake. I tell him, "Well, do it then, 'cause I'm not moving." My shadow has covered him completely now, and he doesn't move. Like I thought, he's all talk. He pulls grass out of the ground and throws it to the road. He tears at it like his hair. His hands are ferocious. After a while, I sit down in the gutter a few meters away and get my mouth to wreck the nothingness that has followed his threat. "What happened?" I ask, but I don't look at him. It'll work if I don't look. His answer is succinct. He says,
"My brother's a complete asshole and I want to kill him."
"Well, good for you." He flares.
"Are you taking the piss out of me?"
I shake my head, still refusing to look at him. "No, I'm not. You little bastard," I think. He starts repeating it now.
"I want to kill him. I want to kill him. I want to kill him."
His angry hair shrouds his face. His freckles light up under the streetlight. I look at the boy and think about what I have to do. I wonder if these Rose boys have ever been tested in the world. They're about to be. Jack of Clubs. The Colour of Her Lips. Thursday afternoon appears to be travelling well. Angie Caruso goes through her usual routine at work and picks up her kids from school. She walks with them to the park, and they discuss which ice creams they're going to buy. One of them makes a cunning decision to get a cheaper one so he can have two. He suggests it to Angie, and she tells him he's still only allowed one. He then switches back to a more expensive choice. They go into the shop, and I wait in the park. I sit on one of the far benches and wait for them to come out. Once they do, I go into the shop myself and try to figure out what kind of ice cream Angie Caruso would like. "Hurry up," I think, "or they'll be gone by the time you come back out." In the end, I decide on two flavors, peppermint choc chip and passion fruit, in a waffle cone. When I walk out, the kids are still scoffing down their own ice creams. They're all on the bench. I go over. I topple over my words, surprised that they come out properly. "Excuse me, I..." Angie and the kids all turn and face me. Up close, Angie Caruso is beautiful and awkward. "I've seen you here a few times and noticed that you never get an ice cream yourself." She looks at me as if I'm a lunatic. "I thought you deserved one too." Clumsily, I hold it out to her. It already streams green and yellow down the side of the cone. She eases her hand out gingerly and takes it, her expression startled and half broken. For quite a few seconds, she looks at it. Then her tongue rescues the streams on the side of the cone. When she's cleaned it up enough, she attempts a bite as if it's the original sin. Should I or shouldn't I? She looks at me warily again before sinking her teeth into the peppermint chalk. Her lips go light green right about the time her boys go charging down to the slippery dip. Only the girl stays and points out, "Looks like you got an ice cream as well today, Mum." Angie strokes the fringe from her daughter's eyes. "Yes, Casey, looks like it, doesn't it? Go on," she tells her. "Go play with your brothers." Casey goes, and now it's only she and me at the bench. It's a warm day and humid. Angie Caruso eats her ice cream, and I wonder what to do with my hands. She works her mouth around the peppermint and onto the passion fruit now, nice and slow. She uses her tongue to push it down so the cone won't be empty. She looks like she couldn't stand it if the cone was empty. As she eats, she watches her kids. They barely notice that I'm there, more intent on calling out to their mother and arguing about who's going higher on the swings. "They're beautiful," Angie says to the cone. "Most of the time." She shakes her head and talks on. "I was the easy one when I was younger. Now I've got three kids and I'm alone." She looks at the swings, and I can see she's imagining what they'd look like if the kids weren't there. The guilt of this holds her down momentarily. It appears to be there constantly, never far away, despite her love for them. I realize that nothing belongs to her anymore, and she belongs to everything. She cries, momentarily, as she watches. She allows herself at least that. There are tears on her face and ice cream on her lips. It doesn't taste like it used to. Still, when she stands up, Angie Caruso thanks me. She asks my name, but I tell her it isn't important. "No," she protests. "It is." I relent. "It's Ed." "Well, thanks, Ed," she says. "Thank you." She thanks me a few times more, but the best words I hear all day come to me right when I think it's over. It's the girl, Casey. She twists herself onto Angie's hand and says, "Next week I'll give you a bite of mine, Mum." In a way, I feel sad and empty, but I also feel that I've done what was intended. Just once. An ice cream for Angie Caruso. I'll always remember the color of it on her lips. Queen of Clubs. Blood and Roses. Now I have to deal with the roses. And like I've said, I don't think they've been tested in the world. It seems they've never been asked how they would react if someone from outside came in and interrupted their fighting with foreign fists. I have their address. I have their phone number. And I'm ready. Early next week, I get a lot of day shifts, and I go over there every night I have free. Each time, they only argue. There's no actual fight, so I go home, disappointed. On the way back, I look for the closest phone booth to their house and find one a few streets away. The next two nights I have to work, which I decide is a good thing. They had a big fight only recently, and they might need a few more days to build up properly to another one. All I need is Gavin to leave the house again. My job isn't a pleasant one. On Sunday night, it happens. I'm there for nearly 2 hours when the house shakes and Gavin storms out again. He goes back to the same place and sits again in the gutter. And again, I go down there. My shadow only edges onto him when he says, "You again." But he doesn't even get a glimpse of me. My hands reach down and grab him by the collar. I feel like I'm outside myself. I watch myself drag Gavin Rose into the bush and beat him down to the grass, the dirt and the fallen tree branches. My fists clutter on his face and I put a hole in his stomach. The boy cries and begs. His voice twitches. "Don't kill me. Don't kill me." I see his eyes and make sure not to meet them, and I put my fist onto his nose to eliminate any vision he might have had. He's hurt, but I keep going. I need to make sure he can't move by the time I'm done with him. I can smell how scared he is. It pours out of him. It reaches up and stuffs itself into my nose. I realize this could all backfire terribly, but it feels like my only option. It's time to explain that before I had to sort out Edgar Street, I'd never even laid a finger on a person in this way. It doesn't feel good, especially when it's a young kid who doesn't have a chance. However, I can't let that stop me. I'm possessed as I continue beating Gavin Rose on his body and face. It's dark, and a gathering wind stalks through the bush. No one can help him, except me. And how do I do it? I give him one last kick and make sure he won't be able to move for at least another 5 or 10 minutes. I get off him, breathing heavily. Gavin Rose isn't going anywhere. There's blood on my hands as I walk quickly from the bush and up the street. I can hear the television in the Rose house as I hurry past. When I turn the corner and see the phone booth, I discover a big problem. There's someone in it.
"Well, I don't care what she says,"
a very large teenage girl with a navel ring booms inside the box.
"It has nothing to do with me."
I can't help it. I think, "Get out of there, you silly bitch." But she only gets more articulate. "One minute," I decide. "I'll give her 1 minute and then I'm going in." She sees me but clearly couldn't care less. She turns around and continues talking. "Right, I'm going in," and I knock on the glass. She responds by turning round and asking,
"What?"
The word is spoken like gunshot. I try manners. "Sorry to bother you, but I really need to make an urgent call."
"Piss off, mate."
She's not happy, to say the least. "Look," I hold up my hands and show her the blood on my palms. "A friend of mine just had an accident and I have to call an ambulance." She talks into the phone again.
"Kel? Yeah, I'm back. Listen, I'll call you back in a minute."
She stares at me obscenely when she says that.
"Okay?"
When she hangs up, she saunters out and I can smell a mixture of her sweat and deodorant inside the booth. It isn't too charming, but it isn't a smell of dormant proportions either. I shut the door and dial. 3 rings and Daniel Rose picks up the phone. "Yeah, hello?" I whisper, nice and hard. "Now you listen to me. If you go down to the bush at the end of your street, you'll find your brother in a pretty bad way. I strongly suggest you get down there." "Who is this?" I hang up. "Thank you," I say to the girl on my way out.
"Better not be any blood on the phone."
Nice girl. Back on the Roses Street, I make it just in time to see. Daniel Rose is helping his brother walk back to their house. I'm far away, but I can see him supporting him with his arm around his shoulder. For the first time, they look like brothers. I even let myself imagine some words for them. "Come on, Gav. You can make it. We'll get you home and fix you up." There is blood on my hands and blood at the bottom of the street. I hope for a moment that they both understand what they're doing and what they're proving. I want to tell them, but I realize that all I do is deliver the message. I don't decipher it or make sense of it for them. They need to do that for themselves. I can only hope they're capable, as I make my way home to some running water and the doorman. King of Clubs. The Face of Clubs. Well, I must say, I'm very pleased with myself. There were 3 names carved into that great rock at the Stones of Home, and I'm quite sure I fulfilled everything I had to do. I walk down to the river with the doorman and head upstream to where the names are in the rock. It gets a little rough for the doorman on the way up, and I look at him, disappointed. "You had to come, didn't you? I told you it was going to be a hard one for you, but did you listen?"
"I'll just wait here," he replies.
I give him a pat as he lies down and I keep going up the river. As I climb the large stones, I feel a pride swelling in me. It's a great feeling to be going there again in victory after the uncertainty of my first visit. It's late afternoon, but not hot, so I'm barely sweating when my eyes hit the names. Immediately, I notice there's something different. They're the same names, but next to them, there's also a tick scratched in, obviously for each time I completed what I had to do. I'm very happy to see the first name. Thomas O'Reilly. Big tick. Then Angie Caruso. Another one. Then...
what?
I look at the stone in disbelief, as the name Gavin Rose is still naked and alone in the tick department. I stand there with my arm bent around my body, scratching my spine. "What do I still need to do?" I ask. Gavin Rose was as complete as they come. The answer can't be far away. A few days pass, and the end of November is near. It's getting close to the annual sledge game. Marv's been calling me up, still agitated about my apparent lack of interest. December hits, and 2 nights before the game, I'm still nervous about Gavin Rose and that invisible tick on the stone. I've been back there and there's still nothing. I hoped whoever was doing that part was just running late, but there's no way 3 or 4 days could pass. Whoever's running this would never allow that to happen. I'm having trouble sleeping. I'm irritable with the doorman. When I haven't slept again after Thursday, I go to the all-night chemist at the top of Main Street to get something, anything, to help me sleep. I should have saved some of the sleeping pills I slipped the man from Edgar Street. As I walk out, I notice a group of boys hanging round across the road. Nearing home, it becomes obvious that they're following me, and when we're all standing at an intersection, waiting for the legs to go green, I notice the voice of Daniel Rose.
This him, Gav?
I try to fight them off, but there are too many. At least six. They drag me into an alley and handle me in much the same way I took care of Gavin. They club me with their hands and hold me down and all take turns. I can feel blood crawling across my face and bruises showing up along my ribs, my legs, and my stomach. They enjoy themselves.
Teach you to mess with my brother?
This is Daniel Rose making conversation. He kicks me hard in the ribs. The loyalty hurts.
Come on, Gav. Take the last shot.
Gav does as he's told. He reefs a boot to my stomach and forces his fist into my face. They run off into the night. As for me, I try to get up but fall. I drag myself home and feel like I've come full circle from when I had the Ace of Clubs first delivered. When I stagger through the front door, the doorman looks shocked, almost concerned. All I can do is shake my head and assure him I'm okay with a small, painful smile. I imagine that while all this is going on, a large tick is being scratched into the stone next to the name of Gavin Rose. It's over. Later that night, I look in the bathroom mirror. Two black eyes, swollen jaw, a bloodstream flowing to my throat. I look at myself and try my hardest to attempt a smile. Well done, Ed, I tell myself, and I stare for a final few seconds at my broken and bloodied face. I stare strangely into the face of clubs. Part 3. Trying Times for Ed Kennedy. Ace of Spades. The Game. A mosquito sings in my ear, and I almost feel grateful for the company. I'm even tempted to sing along. It's dark, there's blood on my face, and the mosquito could easily sit and drink without injecting. It could kneel down and sip the blood from my right cheek and my lips. When I get out of bed and stand up, the floor is cool and my feet enjoy the relief. My sheets felt woven together with sweat, and now I lean on the wall in the hallway. Some sweat reaches my ankle and rolls under the arch of my foot. I don't feel bad. Laughter escapes my mouth as I check the clock, go to the bathroom, and have a cold shower. The icy water sets fire to my cuts and bruises, but everything feels good. It's close to 4 in the morning now, and I'm no longer afraid. After putting on a pair of old jeans and nothing else, I walk back to bed in search of the two aces. I open the drawer and lift the cards in my fingers. The yellow light of the room stands next to me as I happily look down at the stories of those cards. I'm gripped by feeling when I think of Miller and Edgar Street, and I hope for a brilliant life for Sophie. I laugh about Father O'Reilly, Henry Street, and Meet a Priest Day. Then Angie Caruso, whom I wish I could have done more for, and those bastard Rose boys. What will the next card be, I wonder? I expect it to be hearts. I wait for daylight and the next ace. This time I want it to be fast. I want the card right now. No obscurity, no riddles. Just give me the addresses. Give me the names and send me there. That's what I want. My only worry is that every time I've wanted something to go a certain way in all of this, it's gone the other, designed perfectly to challenge me with the unknown. I want Keith and Daryl to come walking through the door again. I want them to deliver the next card and criticize the doorman for his smell and for having fleas. I've even left the door unlocked so they can enter my house in a civilized manner. But I know they're not coming. I find my book and head to the lounge room. I take the aces with me and hold them as I read. When I wake up again, I'm on the floor with the two cards next to my left hand. It's about 10 already and it's hot and someone's banging at the door. It's them, I think. Keith, I call out, getting to my knees. Daryl, that you?
Who the hell's Keith?
I look up and see Marv standing over me. I rub my eyes. What are you doing here? I ask him.
Is that any way to speak to friends?
He sees my face properly now and the black and yellow rods that are my ribs.
God,
I see him think, but he doesn't say it. He answers my question with an answer to a different question. This is typically frustrating of Marv. Instead of saying what he's doing here, he tells me how he got in.
The door was unlocked, and the doorman let me pass for a change.
See? I told you he's okay. I walk through to the kitchen with Marv behind me. He asks about the state of me.
How'd you end up like that, Ed?
I switch the kettle on. Coffee?
Yes, please.
Of course, the doorman's just walked in.
Thanks,
Marv answers. As we drink, I tell Marv what happened. Just some young fellas. They had a look at me and took me from behind.
You get any shots in of your own?
No.
Why not?
There were 6 of them, Marv.
He shakes his head. Christ, the world's going crazy.
He decides to get back to something sane.
Do you think you'll be right to play this afternoon?
Of course. The sledge game. Today's the day. Yes, Marv, I make the answer very clear. I'm playing. I'm suddenly very in the mood for this year's game. Despite being a physical disaster, I feel stronger than ever, and I'm actually relishing the idea of being hurt some more. Don't ask me why. I don't understand it myself.
Come on.
Marv stands up and begins for the door.
I'll buy you some breakfast.
Really? This isn't like Marv at all. As we leave, I ask him for the truth. Would you be doing this if I pulled out of the game? Marv opens his car and gets in.
No way.
At least he's honest. His car doesn't start.
Not one word.
He eyes me. We both snigger slightly. This is a good day. I can feel it. We walk to a crappy cafe at the bottom of Main Street. They serve eggs and salami and some sort of flat-looking bread. The waitress is a big woman with a wide mouth and a hanky in her hand. For some reason, to me, she looks like a Margaret.
What do you two boars want?
We're shocked.
Boars?
Asks Marv. She gives us an I don't have time for this kind of look. She's bored shitless.
Of course. You're both boars, ain't you?
It's then I realize she's saying boys. Hey, I say to Marv, boys.
What?
Boys. Marv peruses the menu. Margaret clears her throat. Not wanting to annoy her further, I order fast. I'll have a banana milkshake if that's okay. She frowns.
We're out of milk.
Out of milk? How in the hell can a cafe run out of milk?
Look, I don't buy the milk. I don't have anything to do with the milk. I only know we don't have any. Why don't you order something to eat?
She loves a job, this lady. I can sense it. Have you got bread? I ask.
Now, don't get smart, boar.
I scout the rest of the cafe, checking out what everyone else is eating. I'll have what that bloke over there's having. All 3 of us look over.
You sure? Marv warns. That looks pretty borderline, Ed.
Well, at least they've got it, haven't they? And now Margaret's really unhappy. She says,
Now listen.
She scratches her scalp with her pen. I'm almost waiting for her to clean her ears out with it.
If this place isn't good enough for you boars, you can bloody well piss off and find somewhere else to eat.
She's very testy, to say the least. All right, I hold my hand up, almost backing away. Give me what that guy's got and just a banana, okay?
Good thinking, Marv approves. Potassium for the game.
Potassium? I don't think that's really going to help.
And you?
Margaret's transferred her attention now to Marv. He shifts in his seat.
How about that flatbread you've got with your finest selection of cheeses?
He had to do it. Marv can't resist being a smart-ass to a person like this. It's in his nature. But Margaret's good. She puts up with complete shitheads like us all the time.
The only cheese around here is you,
she responds, and I must say, we both laugh and give her some encouragement. She chooses not to notice.
Anything else for you, boars?
No, thanks.
Right. That's $22.50.
$22.50?
We can't hide our exasperation.
Well, yeah, this is a classy joint, you know.
That's obvious. The service is incredible. And now we sit in the boiling hot outdoor section of the cafe, sweating and waiting for this breakfast. Margaret takes great pleasure in passing us while she delivers other people's food. We're close to asking her a few times just where ours has vanished to, but we know that will only serve to make us wait longer. People are actually eating lunch before we eat our breakfast, and when it finally comes, Margaret slops it down on our table like she's serving us compost.
Cheers, love, Marv says. You've outdone yourself.
Margaret blows her nose and walks off.
Savage indifference. How's yours?
Inquires Marv soon after.
Or more to the point, what is it?
Eggs and cheese and something.
Do you even like eggs?
No,
Then why'd you get it?
Well, it didn't look like eggs when it was on that other guy's plate.
Fair enough.
You want some of mine? I take up the offer and eat some of his flatbread. Not bad, really. And I finally ask Marv exactly why he's chosen today, of all days, to take me out to breakfast. It's never happened before. I've never gone out for breakfast in my life. That, and Marv would never even consider paying for me. That simply wouldn't be on. Under normal circumstances, he'd rather die. Marv, I say, looking straight at him, why are we here? He shakes his head.
Well, I...
You're making sure I turn up to the game this afternoon, aren't you? You're sweetening me up. Marv can't lie to me on this, and he knows it.
That would about cover it.
I'll be there, I tell him, 4 o'clock sharp.
Good.
The rest of the day glides by. Thankfully, Marv gives me the next few hours off, so I go home and sleep some more. When the time comes around, I walk to the grounds with the doorman, who has picked up on my recent happiness, despite the mess I appear to be. We stop off at Audrey's. No one home. Maybe she's already at the grounds. She does hate the rugby, but she's always there, every year. It's nearly 3:45 when we walk into the valley where the grounds are, and I remember Sophie and me here, over at the athletic track. It makes this game look pitiful, which it is. A crowd is already gathering at the field, while the athletic track is empty, but for barefoot images of the girl. I watch the beauty for as long as I can, then turn and face the rest of it. The closer I get, the stronger the smell of beer. It's hot. About 32. The two teams are in different corners of the field, and a crowd of a few hundred is slowly growing bigger. It's always a bit of an event, the sledge game. It's held the first Saturday of December every year, and I think this is the fifth time it's been put on. As for me, this is my third year. I leave the doorman in the shade of a tree, and when I approach the team, the ones who notice me take a second look at my face. Their interest, however, leaves them pretty fast. They're the type of people who see bruises and blood quite a lot. Within 5 minutes, I'm thrown a blue jersey with red and yellow stripes on it. Number 12. I change from my jeans into a pair of black shorts. There are no socks and no boots. They're the rules of the sledge game. No boots and no protective gear. Just a jersey, shorts, and a foul mouth. That's all you need. Our team is known as the Colts. The opposition is the Falcons. They wear a green and white jersey with the same colour shorts, though no one cares about that. We're lucky to have the jerseys at all, considering each side just flogged them 1 year from one of the real local clubs or took the discarded ones. There are 40-year-old men in the sledge game. Big, ugly firemen or coal miners. Then there are some mid-range players. Some young ones, like Marv, Richie and me, and some that can actually play well. Richie's our last guy to show up. Well, look what the bloody dog brought along, says one of our fat guys. One of his mates tells him it's supposed to be what the cat dragged in, but frankly, Big Fatso's too thick to understand. He's got what we'd call a Merv Hughes moustache. If you don't understand that, all you really need to know is that it's big, it's bushy, and it's downright reprehensible. The saddest comment on all of this is that he also appears to be our captain. I think his real name's Henry Dickens. No relation to Charles. Richie throws down his bag and answers, "Hey, lads, how are we?" But he looks at the ground, and no one really gives a shit about how anyone is. It's 3:55, and most of the team is drinking beer. One gets thrown to me, but I keep it for later. I stand around a bit as the crowd continues piling toward the field, and Richie comes over. He studies me up and down and speaks. "Christ, Ed, you look bloody desperate. All bloodied and messed up and shit." "Thanks." He looks closer. "What happened?" "Ah, just some young fellas having a bit of harmless fun." He pats me on the back, hard enough to hurt. "That'll teach you, won't it?" "For what?" Richie winks at me and finishes his beer. "No idea." You have to love Richie when he's like this. He doesn't care much for how things happen or bother asking why. He can tell I don't particularly feel like discussing the incident, so he makes a crack and we leave it behind us. Richie's a good mate. I find it curious that no one's even suggested that I should have called the police about what happened. You don't do that sort of thing around here. People get mugged or beaten up all the time, and in most cases you either get back straight away or take it. In my case, I'm taking it. Doing a few lazy stretches, I look over at the opposition. They're bigger than us, and I set my eyes on the massive one Marv had been talking about a while back. He's gigantic, and to be honest, I can't tell if it's a man or a woman. In fact, from a distance, he looks like Mimi from the Drew Carey Show. Then, worst of all, I look at his number. It's number 12, like me.
That's who you're marking, says a voice behind me.
I know it's Marv, and Richie comes over as well.
Good luck, Ed, he says, suppressing his amusement.
It makes a burst of laughter shoot from my mouth.
Bloody hell, I'll get flattened by him. Literally.
You sure that's a man?
Marv inquires. I bend down and hold up my toes, stretching the backs of my legs. I'll ask when he's on top of me. Strangely, though, I'm not overly concerned.
The crowd's getting restless.
Right, get in here, says Merv.
That's right. I said Merv, not Marv. I've named the fat guy with the moustache Merv, because I have no confidence at all that his name is in fact Henry. I think his mates call him Merv anyway, on account of the moustache. Everyone gathers in nice and close, and here's where we all get pumped up for the game. It's a collection of nasty underarm sweat, beer breath, missing teeth, and three-day growth.
Right, says Merv. When we get out there, what are we going to do?
No one says anything.
Well?
I don't know. Someone finally says,
"We're going to smash these pricks,"
shouts Merv, and now there's a rumble of agreement, except for Richie, who yawns. A few of the others shout as well now, but it's hardly a wall of sound. They swear and snort and talk of everything short of disemboweling the Falcons. These are grown men, I think. We never grow up. The ref blows his whistle. As always, it's Reggie LaMotta, who is very popular in town for being a complete drunk. The only reason he refs the game is that he gets two free bottles of spirits we all chip in for, one from each side.
All right, let's kill these blokes, is the general consensus, and the side runs on.
Quickly, I head back to the tree where I left the doorman. He's asleep and a small boy is patting him. You want to look after my dog? I ask. Sounds good, he replies. My name's Jay. He's the doorman. And I run onto the field and join the lineup.
Now listen up, fellas, begins Reggie.
His voice is slurred. The game hasn't even begun and the ref's already pissed. It's quite funny, actually.
If there's any of that same shit as last year, I'm walking away and you can ref yourselves.
You won't get your two bottles then, Reg, someone says.
Bullshit, I won't, Reggie sharpens. Now, no rubbish, you hear?
Everyone goes along with it. Thanks, Reggie.
Right, Reg.
Everyone moves forward and we shake hands. I shake with my opposite number, who towers over me and puts me in the shade. I was right. He's a man, all right, but a dead ringer for Mimi from Drew Carey.
Good luck, I say.
Give me a few minutes,
Mimi answers throatily. Some heavy eye makeup would really do the trick.
I'm going to tear you to pieces.
Let the games begin. The Falcons kick off, and soon enough I get my first run. I get killed. Then I have another run. I get killed again. And I also receive the trash talk in my ear as Big Mimi squashes my head into the ground. This is what the sledge game is all about. The crowd is constantly oohing and aahing, screaming obscenities and cracking up. All between drinking beer and wine and eating pies and hot dogs from the same guy who shows up every year to sell them. He sets up shop on the sideline, even catering for the kids with soft drinks and lollies. The Falcons go in to score a few times and spring to a good lead.
What the hell's going on?
Someone asks as we stand next to the posts. It's Big Merv. As captain, he feels he should at least say something.
Jesus, only one of us having a chop, and that's...
Hey, what's your name again?
I'm startled because he's pointing at me. Taken aback, I answer. Ed, I say. Kennedy.
Well, Eddie is the only one running hard and tackling. Now, come on!
I keep running. Mimi keeps monstering and abusing me, and I'm wondering if he'll ever run out of breath. Surely someone that big in this heat can't go much longer. I'm on the ground when Reggie calls halftime and everyone goes off for a beer. Each player will then convince himself, with difficulty, to go back on. During the interval, I lie down in the shade near the doorman and the boy. That's when Audrey turns up. She asks nothing about the state of me because she knows it's just more messenger work. It's becoming normal now. So I don't go into it.
You all right?
She asks.
I sigh happily and say, sure, I'm loving life.
In the second half, there's a turnaround and we fight back. Richie scores in the corner, and then another guy goes in under the posts. It's even. Marv's playing well now too, and it's tight for a long time. Meanie's finally getting tired, and during an injury break, Marv comes over and stirs me up.
Oi, he digs into me. You still haven't hurt that big bloody Sheila yet?
He's all blonde, sticky hair and determined eyes. I object.
Well, look at the size of him, Marv. He's bigger than Mama Grape, for Christ's sake.
Who's Mama Grape?
You know, from that book. I give in. And they made a movie out of it. Don't you remember? Johnny Depp?
Either way, Ed, get up there and give him some.
So I do. There's a guy being assisted from the field, and I go over to Mimi. We look at each other. I say, run at me next time you get the ball. And I walk away, positively shitting myself. Play resumes then, and Mimi does it. He winds up and runs at me, and for some reason, I know that I'm going to do it. He charges onto the ball. I line him up, go forward, and all I hear is the sound.
There's a big collision and everything shakes.
As the crowd goes insane, I realize I'm still standing, and Mimi's lying in a crumpled heap on the ground. Soon everyone's around me, saying great work and such, but a sudden sickness falls to my stomach. I feel awful for what I've done, and the big number 12 on Mimi's back stares forlornly back at me, motionless.
Is he alive? Someone asks.
Who gives a shit? Comes the answer.
I vomit. Slowly, I walk from the field as everyone argues about how to get rid of Mimi so they can resume play.
Just get the stretcher, I hear. We haven't got any, and besides, look at the size of this guy. He's too big anyway. We'll need a bloody crane.
Or a bobcat.
The suggestions are limitless. People like this couldn't care less about digging into someone. You name it. Size, weight, stench. If you've got it, they'll tell you, even if you're stomped all over the ground. The last voice I hear is Big Merv's. He says,
that's the best don't argue I've seen in a long time.
He expressed a great deal of joy in that sentence, and the other players agree with him. I keep walking. I still feel terrible. Guilty. For me, the game's over. The game's over, but something else begins. I make it back to the tree, and the doorman's gone. A familiar fear quickens in me. Two of spades. $20 for the dog and the card. I stand and turn frantically in a circle, trying to find my dog and that kid. Past the field there's a small creek, and I elect to start there. I run as fast as I can in this state, the game forgotten, and from the corner of my eye, I see a girl with yellow hair coming toward me. The doorman, I call to Audrey. He's gone, and I realize how much I love that dog. She joins me for a while, then moves off in a different direction. At the creek, there's nothing. I return to the expansive grass of the field. The game's moving along, and I can still hear the crowd somewhere in the miles at the back of my mind.
Anything?
Audrey asks. She'd been further down the creek.
No.
We stop.
Calmness.
That's the best way, and now, as I turn back to the tree where the doorman sat originally, I see him and the kid going back there. The kid holds a can of drink and a long stick of licorice. And now I see there's someone else with them. She sees me. It's a youngish sort of woman, and when she finds my glare, she quickly kneels down and grabs hold of the kid. She gives him something, speaks, and heads off immediately in the opposite direction. It's the next card, I say to Audrey, and I take off. I run harder than I ever have before. When I reach the boy and the dog, I stop and see that I was right. The kid holds a playing card, but for now, I don't see what suit it is. I resume my pursuit of the young woman. She's disappeared in the crowd, but I run anyway because I'm sure. I feel absolutely certain that I'm chasing a person who at least knows who's behind all this. But she's gone. She's disappeared, and I only stand on the sideline without breath. I could keep chasing, but there's no point. She's gone, and I need to get back to the card. That boy could be ripping it to pieces for all I know. Thankfully, when I make it back, he still holds it. Tightly. He looks like he's not going to let it go without a fight. As it turns out, I'm absolutely correct.
No,
he says. Look, the last thing I want is to muck around with this kid. Just give me the card.
No!
The kid's attempting to cry.
Well, what did that lady say to you? She said,
he wipes his eyes,
that the car belongs to the owner of this dog.
Well, that's me, I say.
No, he's mine. The dog's mine.
Give me Daryl Keith and another trouncing any day, I think. Anything would be better than this kid. All right, I adjust the game plan. I'll give you $10 for the dog and the card. The kid isn't stupid.
20.
I'm displeased, to say the least, but I ask Audrey for a 20 and she gives it to me. I'll pay you later, I tell her.
No worries.
I hand over the 20 and receive the doorman and the card.
Nice doing business with you.
The kid revels in his victory. I feel like strangling him.
It's not what I expect.
Spades, I say to Audrey. She's close enough for her hair to touch my shoulder. The doorman stands on my foot. And you, I accuse him, you stay put next time.
Okay, okay,
he responds, and soon he goes into a coughing fit. Sure enough, a piece of licorice jumps from his mouth, and guilt crawls into his eyes.
That'll teach you,
I point at him viciously. He tries to ignore me.
Is he all right?
Audrey asks as we walk away. Of course, I answer. He'll outlive me, the gluttonous bastard. But secretly, I smile. Three of spades. Dig. Apparently, we won the game, and there's a victory party at Big Merv's place. Marv rings me in the evening and orders me to go, since everyone voted me best player for ironing out old Mimi.
You have to, Ed.
So I go. Again, I stop by at Audrey's on the way, but she's not there. I assume she's out with the boyfriend. It almost turns me off going to Merv's, but I find my way there and go in. No one recognizes me. No one speaks to me. At first, I can't even find Marv, but he locates me later on the front porch.
You made it. How are you feeling?
I look at my friend and say, better than ever. Behind us, we can hear the drunk people yelling and yahooing, and there are people in the front bedroom doing what people do there. We sit a while, and Marv describes the later events of the game to me. He wonders where I disappeared to, but I only tell him that I felt sick and couldn't go on. We talk at length about the hit I put on Mimi.
It was glorious,
Marv confides. Why, thank you. I try to push the edges of guilt back to my stomach. I still feel for him, or her, or whatever. After another 10 minutes or so, I detect that Marv might want to head back inside. In my pocket, I have the new card. Ace of spades. It makes me look deeper into the street, trying to find the future events in store. I'm happy.
What?
Marv asks.
What are you grinning at, boar?
Boar, I think, and we both laugh and connect for a moment.
Come on,
Marv goes on.
What is it, Ed?
Time for digging, I say, and walk off the porch. I have to go, Marv. Sorry, I'll see you later. I feel bad because all I ever seem to do is walk away from Marv these days. Tonight, he allows me some room. I think he finally understands that what's important to him doesn't have to be to me.
Bye, Ed,
he says, and I can tell by his voice. He's happy enough. The night's dark but lovely, and I walk home. At one point, I stop under a blinking streetlight and examine the Ace of Spades again. I'd already looked at it several times, at home and on Merv's front porch. I'm most confused about the choice of suit because I'd expected hearts. Hearts would have followed a red-black pattern, and I thought spades, being the most dangerous-looking suit, would be last. The card has three names on it. Graham Greene, Morris West, Sylvia Plath. The names are familiar, although I'm not too sure why. They're nobody I know, but I've heard of them. Definitely. When I arrive home, I look them up in the local phone book, and there's a Greene and a few Wests, but none with a G or an M before it. Still, there might be other people at those addresses with those names. I make up my mind that I have to travel the town tomorrow. I relax in the lounge room with the doorman. I've made chips in the oven, and we share them. I can feel my body developing some extra soreness from the sledge game, and by midnight, I can barely move. The doorman's at my feet and I sit there, waiting for sleep. My head rolls back. The ace of spades slips from my hand to a crack in the couch. I dream. It's a long night, where I'm trapped inside a dream world and can't decipher whether I'm awake or asleep. When I wake up near morning, I'm still in the sledge game, and I'm chasing the woman who brought the card and arguing with the kid, bargaining. Later, I dream that I'm in school again, but no one else is there. It's only me, and the air in the classroom is dusty yellow. I'm sitting there with books strewn on the desk and words on the board. The words are in cursive, and I can't decipher them. A woman walks in. A teacher with long, skinny legs, black skirt, white blouse, and purple cardigan. She's nearly 50, but sexy in some way. She ignores me for the most part, until a bell rings, loudly, as if it's right outside the room. That's the first time she even acknowledges my existence. She looks up. Time to start, Ed. I'm ready. Yes? Could you read the words behind me, please? I can't. Why in God's name not? I focus harder on the words, but still can't make them out. She's shaking her head at me now. I don't see it, but feel the disappointment as I glue my eyes to the desk. I stare for a long time and actually feel upset that I've let this woman down. A few minutes later, I hear it. A whipping noise, followed by some creaking, reaches into my ears. I look up, and what greets my sight is a shock. It boots the breath from my lungs. The teacher is hanging from a rope in front of the blackboard. She's dead. She swings. The ceiling's gone and the rope is tied tightly around one of the rafters. Horrified, I sit there, suffocating on air that seems to have no oxygen as I breathe it frantically in. My hands stick to the table, so much that I need to pry them off when I stand up and attempt to run out for help. My right hand hits the door handle when, slowly, I stop and turn again to the woman hanging from the rope. Slow, almost creeping, I walk over to face her. Just when I think she looks even vaguely peaceful, her eyes shock open and she speaks. It's strangled and coarse, her voice.
Recognize the words now, Ed?
She says, and I'm left standing there, looking beyond her at the board. Now I see the title at the top and understand what it says. Barren Woman. That's when the body tumbles to the floor at my feet, and I wake. Now it's the doorman at my feet, and the dusty yellow air is in the lounge room from the rising sun outside. The dream lunges at me a few seconds after I open my eyes, and I see the woman, the words, and the title again. I feel her falling at my feet and hear what she said. Recognize the words now, Ed? Barren woman, I whisper. I know I've heard it before. In fact, I know I've read a poem called Barren Woman. I read it in school because I had a depressed English teacher. She loved that poem, and I recall some of the lines even today. Words like, the least footfall, and museum without statues, and comparing her life to a fountain that rises and falls back into itself. Barren woman. Barren woman. I rise fast when it comes to me. I nearly trip over the doorman, who, by the way, is not impressed. He gives me a look of, you just woke me, pal. Barren woman, I tell him. So what? I repeat the title, and this time I grab him joyously by the snout, because now I know the answer to the ace of spades. Or at least, I'm on the way. The poem Barren Woman was written by a woman who committed suicide, and I'm pretty sure of it. Her name was Sylvia Plath. I search the couch for the card and see her name again, third on the list. They're writers, I think. They're all writers. Graham Greene, Morris West, and Sylvia Plath. It surprises me that I've never heard of the first two, but then you can't know of everyone who ever wrote a book. But I know for sure about Sylvia. We're even on a first-name basis now. That's how proud of myself I am. I rejoice in the moment for quite a while, feeling like I've unlocked some great mystery by accident. I'm incredibly stiff now, and my ribs are killing me, but I'm still able to eat cereal with milk that's dubious, to say the least, and loads of sugar. It's around 7:30 when I discover that I've only solved part of the problem. I still have no idea where I have to go or what messages I need to deliver. I'll start at the library, I think. It's a shame it's Sunday. It won't open till later. Audrey comes over. We watch a movie she highly recommends. It's good. I refrain from asking her where she was last night. I tell her about the spades, the names, and that I'm heading over to the library in the afternoon. I'm pretty sure it's open on Sunday between 12 and 4. When she drinks the coffee I made, I look at the redness of her lips and wish I could just stand up, walk over, and kiss them. I want to feel the flesh of them and the softness against my own. I want to breathe in her and with her. I want to be able to put my teeth to her neck and have my fingers touch her back and run them through the lovely, mild yellow color of her hair. Honestly, I don't know what it is this morning, but soon I understand why I feel like this. I deserve something. I'm going around fixing people's lives, even just for a moment or two. I'm hurting people that need hurting when inflicting pain goes against everything that comes naturally to me. I at least deserve something, I reason. Audrey could love me just for a second, surely. But I know, without doubt, I know nothing will happen. She won't kiss me. She'll barely touch me. I'm running all over town, getting trodden on, beaten up, abused, and for what? What do I get out of it? What's in it for Ed Kennedy? I'll tell you what. Nothing. But I'm lying. I'm lying. And I vow, right this instant, to stop. I've been through all this and thought I'd really turned a corner after the Ace of Clubs. I stop. Stop everything. And I do something stupid. I stand up completely on impulse and walk over to Audrey and kiss her on the mouth. I feel the red lips and the flesh and the air inside her. And with my eyes closed, I feel her for just a second. I feel all of her and it rushes past me, through me and past me and over me, and I'm hot and cold and shivering and shot down. I'm shot down by the sound of my mouth slipping away from hers till silence staggers between us. I taste blood. Then I see blood on Audrey's lips that are on Audrey's surprised face. God, I couldn't even kiss her properly. I couldn't do it without opening up and bleeding on her. I close my eyes. I clench them shut. Soon I stop everything and say, I'm sorry, Audrey. I turn away. I didn't know what I was doing. And the words stop now, too. They cut themselves down before it's too late, and the two of us stand in the kitchen. We both have blood on our lips. She doesn't want to feel that way about me, and I can accept that, but I wonder if she'll ever know that no one will love her as hard as I do. She wipes the blood from her mouth, and I say again how sorry I am. Audrey is as gracious as ever and takes the apology, explaining that she just can't do that sort of thing with me. I think she'd rather do it without any meaning or truth, just what it is, without the risk of any of that. If she doesn't want love from anyone, I have to respect that. Don't worry, Ed, she says, and she means it. One great thing is that Audrey and I are always okay. Somehow, we manage it. It doesn't seem to matter what happens. I consider this fact for a moment, and to be perfectly honest, I wonder how long it can possibly last. Surely not forever. Give us a smile, Ed, she says later, when she's leaving. I can't help it. I give her one. Good luck with the spades, she says. Thanks. The door closes. It's nearly 12 now, and I put on my shoes and head for the library. I still feel stupid. Now, it's true that I've read a lot of books, but I bought them all, mainly from second-hand bookshops. The last time I actually used a library, they still had big, long catalog drawers. Even at school, when the computers came in as stock standard, I still used the drawers. I like pulling out the card of an author and seeing the books listed. When I walk into the library, I'm expecting an old lady behind the counter, but it's a young guy, about my age, with long, curly hair. He's a bit of a smart mouth, but I like him. You got any of those cards? I ask him. What kind of cards? Playing cards? Library cards? Credit cards? He's enjoying himself. What exactly do you mean? I can tell he's trying to make me look uneducated and useless, though I really don't need his help. You know, I explain to him, the cards with all the writers and authors and that. Oh, and he laughs fully now. You haven't been in a library for a long time, have you? No, I say. Now I really feel uneducated and useless. I might as well wear a sign that says Total Dropkick on it. I act on it. But I've read Joyce and Dickens and Conrad.
Who are they?
Now I have the upper hand.
What? You haven't read those guys? You call yourself a librarian?
He acknowledges me now with a devious smile.
Touché.
Touché. I can't stand that expression. Nonetheless, the guy becomes a lot more helpful now. He says,
we don't use those cards anymore. It's all on the computer.
Come on.
We go over to the computers and he says, right, give me an author.
I stutter because I don't want to tell him one of the people on the Ace of Spades. They're mine.
I give him Shakespeare.
He types it in and all the titles come up on the screen. Then he types in the number next to Macbeth and says,
there it is.
You got it? I read the screen and understand.
Thanks.
Just yell out if you need me.
No worries.
He goes off, and I'm alone with the keys, the writers, and the screen. First up, I go for Graham Greene. I'll go in the same order as they're listed on the card. I search my pocket for some paper, but all I've got is a decrepit napkin. There's a pen tied to the table, and when I punch the name in and hit return, all the titles of Graham Greene come up on screen. Some of the titles are brilliant. The Human Factor, Brighton Rock, The Heart of the Matter, The Power and the Glory, Our Man in Havana. I write them all on the napkin, as well as the call number for the first one. Next, I type West, Morris. Some of his titles are just as good, if not better. Gallows on the Sand, The Shoes of the Fisherman, Children of the Sun, The Ringmaster, The Clowns of God. Now, Sylvia. I must admit, I have a soft spot for her because I've read her once, and it was her writing that came to me in the dream. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be sitting here, closer to knowing where I have to go. I want her titles to be the best, and whether it's biased or not, to me, they are. The Winter Ship, The Colossus, Ariel, Crossing the Water, The Bell Jar. I take the napkin to the shelves and look them all up again, in order. They're all beautiful. All old and hard-covered in plain red or blue or black. I take all of them, every one, and I go and sit down with them. What now? How the hell am I going to read all of these in a week or two? The poems of Sylvia, maybe, but the other two have written some pretty long books, to say the least. I hope they're good.
Listen, says the library man. I'm at the counter with all the books.
You can't borrow this many. There's a limit, you know. Do you even have a card?
What kind of card? I can't help it. A playing card? A credit card? What kind of card do you mean?
Okay, smartass.
We both enjoy the moment, and he reaches under his counter and gives me a sheet of paper.
Fill this out, please.
Once I receive the card, I try buttering him up a little to get my hands on all the books.
Thanks, mate. You're doing a hell of a job.
He looks up.
You still want all those books, don't you?
That's right. I pile them up onto the counter from the floor. Basically, I really need them, and one way or the other, I'm going to get them. Only in today's sick society can a man be persecuted for reading too many books. I look back into the emptiness of the library. They're hardly jumping off the shelves now, are they? I don't think anyone else wants them just now. He allows me to talk, going through the motions.
Look, to be honest, he says, I personally couldn't give a pinch of shit how many you borrow. It's regulations. If my boss catches me, I'm in it.
In what?
I don't bloody know, but I'll be in it deep.
Still, I look at him, not giving an inch.
He caves in. All right, give them here. Let's see what I can rig up for you.
He starts scanning them. My boss is a total knob anyway. When he's done, there are exactly 18 books on the other side of the counter.
Thanks, I tell him. Much appreciated. How am I going to get them all home? I ask myself.
I consider ringing Marv for a lift, but I manage on my own. I drop some along the way, rest a few times, but in the end, each book makes it home.
My arms are killing me.
I didn't know words could be so heavy. All afternoon, I read. I fall asleep once as well. No disrespect to the writers. I'm still worn out from the rose beating and the sledge game. As I read, I enjoy the work of Graham Greene. I don't pick up any clues as to where I have to go, but I think it must be simpler than this. I look over at the small book mountains I've built. It's demoralizing, to say the least. How am I ever going to find out what I need among those thousands of pages? When I wake up, a southerly's blowing outside, and it's actually pretty cool for this time of year. It being early December, I feel a little strange going to put a sweatshirt on. I walk past the front door and see a piece of paper lying there.
No, it's a napkin.
Anxious, my eyes close for a second, and I bend down to pick it up.
It really brings home the fact that I've been followed all this time. They watched me go to the library. They watched me in the library.